Accession number 30279, Reel 8.
And the Japanese had surrendered. Well, they might have surrendered in Japan, but we're sitting in the middle of Borneo. So obviously there is going to be quite a, what you might call a pregnant pause before, and no one's going to stick their head up till everything's all simmered down. So we just took control of the Samangan, kept the Japanese officers in jail. Don't think they liked that, quite frankly, but still, it was better to have them in there. We knew where they were, and then there was a, and we were in and about the town, and Dave was trying to get a little bit of administration going, you know, to find out who was sort of the head man and things like that, which they came out of the woodwork. And
what sort of contact did you have with these officers? Were you able to glean how they saw you as an enemy?
One of our boys, I must admit, he might have been a bit naughty, but I suppose that knowing full well what the Japanese had been doing to our POWs. So he thought he'd get them out for exercise in the morning. Now the exercise was actually cleaning the drains in the main bazaar area. And of course the local population loved that because they'd been browbeaten for about 4 years. And of course they lost face. The worst thing you can do to so that was a morning occurrence of them out exercising and cleaning and sweeping and what have you. It wasn't long after that
did you actually know about what the Japanese had done? Presumably this was all sort of hearsay or something you'd heard from other people.
Oh, well, from the local population, no, we heard plenty. And especially, you see, in our group, you might say, there were ex-district officers. As I mentioned, there was Major Fisher, who they pronounced, of course, as Pisser. And he was able to glean by not interrogation, but just to have leading natives. See, they all had a station before the war with the Raja Vina Brook, but they were a Pengaloo, and he'd be in charge of about four longhouses, and also and a Tuaruma, and he'd be in charge of the longhouse. So there was plenty of people to go to and get information from, and particularly when they knew Fisher pre-war, because they had no problem communicating with him and telling him the facts.
So how did you see the Japanese as now you're captives? What were your impressions of the enemy now, and how do you think they saw you?
I don't think they saw us in a very good light. I don't think the Japanese, of course, were always immaculately attired. They had their polished boots, and carried their sword and what have you. And I must admit, we didn't look terribly well regimentally dressed. Jungle greens and certainly no spit and polish or brass shiny buttons or anything like that. So I guess that we didn't come across too well to them. And we felt that what they were doing, of course, that they really hadn't seen any what you might call any active service for some years. They were just the occupation force and a disciplinary force to keep the local population under control. So things are starting to wind down now.
What were your impressions then when you heard of this bomb being dropped? Out of the blue.
Yeah, well, it was out of the blue. And it's rather hard for us to believe it till obviously our SIG was getting a little bit of what called hard copy, factual stuff through. We've only got a pretty primitive communication to headquarters. It was just a little pedal wireless and to supply the power from and get one of the natives to whiz up and throw an aerial up a tree. But they were very similar to us because they were on the Rajang, as you know, and they are starting to communicate with the big garrison at Cebu. They've got to get Soshin's got to get the commanding officer there to surrender. So they might have surrendered in Tokyo, but they certainly hadn't surrendered down in Borneo or in Sarawak. So it was a rather, you might say, just a time that you took step by step without. In our area, a naval launch, when I say a launch, it was a patrol boat possibly, but not terribly big. It came up the Semungan River. And they had a couple of guys on board from the administration, which has obviously all been sort of poised for when the Allies did take control, so they could get in and get some civil administration going. And so when they arrived, and Dave Carney handed over and told them where we were and what we were doing, and there were some Japanese in the Kubu, and so really our job had done. So Dave said, "Now look, we're not going to walk over that dash, 2,300 range again." So we had old Sarawak money, which had obviously been printed in England and come out to us. So he had a chat to one of the local fishermen who had a reasonable size launch. So he negotiated with him to take us to Cebu. So we went down the Semungan River, and suddenly we heard this noise coming, and our skipper said, we said, "What's that now? I can hear just like a roar." And he said, that's the ball. It's the incoming tide, and it's like a surf, sort of like about a couple of foot high wave. roaring up the river. So he just sort of shook on the side of the bank while it all simmered down, and then so we went out to sea and up the coast, and how he found the mouth of the Rajang River, I don't know, because all you're looking at is, you know, just a great mass of mangrove of all sorts of things growing, jungle and what have you. And anyway, we finished up at Cebu, where we found out, obviously, from having a chat to the boys, that they had negotiated with our party, the Major Station, and negotiated with the Japanese commanding officer, which it took, I believe, quite a bit of time. Of course, we weren't privy to it, so we only hear say that he decided to, and then they didn't have enough, obviously, and enough troops to, you know, go and then sort of surround them and do anything. So he negotiated with him to take them to this island, which was just out, so they could all be isolated. At any rate, that went on. And then we were just going to wait for a Catalina. So we were there and you've got no idea, we couldn't get over it. The place was absolutely filthy. Everything was filthy. You wouldn't think they could live like that.
I was going to ask, you know, what were your impressions of... of their condition, apart from
anything. The conditions were absolutely dreadful. And just shows you their discipline.
What about their physical condition?
Oh, okay. Their food was... well, of course, their supply lines had been severed for some time. So... physically, they weren't like starving like they had our POWs. And, of course, as I said earlier on, that they got most of their food were taken from the natives. So, so they didn't really starve, but not as normal. But I'm just talking about their living conditions, you know, where they slept and... where they it's quite incredible. Which we were living proof, and I was, and my friend was, that, anyway, we were only there for about, might have been 10 days or so, might have been less than that, and a Catalina came in and picked the bulk of us up. A Catalina, and I suppose there might have been about 20 or so got on board, or 15, something like that, and flew us back to Labuan, where we had our own headquarters. And by this time, I'm scratching all over, and I said to my mate, I think we better go and get checked over at the RAP and the. And they said, you've got scabies. And I said, sleeping in this damn filthy Cebu. So the matron had one look at us, said, where have you been sleeping? We've been living with the natives for months and months and months. And I said, not a thing wrong. I said, we just put our foot in the Japanese occupied area, and this is what we've got. So she called the orderly, and he came in with a paintbrush, about a 6-inch paintbrush, and painted us all over. So I believe you suffocate these damn things so they can't breathe. And so we sat in there for a week till we got discharged. So that was a little gift the Japs gave us.
What was the attitude that you perceived the Japanese had when you came across them in Cebu? What was their general morale like?
I didn't really see many.
Okay.
Because, you see, they'd been shunted off of this island, And no, in other words, I didn't.
So here you are in Lab 1, obviously getting over your scabies. What happened next?
So, we had our camp, which, matter of fact, it was the Z Special or SRD headquarters was right on the coast, which was rather pleasant. You could have a swim. You had to be careful because you didn't get that damn coral ear, but you could swim. And then they organised things after we did a lot of debriefing and what have you. And
what did that entail?
Oh, that was just, you know, getting you to wind up what you've been doing and getting your details and things, because, you know, you're a little bit out of contact with normal sort of communication, as we were, especially when we got down to Samungan. And then we, from then on in, we had to wait. The people that went first were obviously married, children, and bachelors, like most of us. We were just on the... So a lot of sport, played rugby, because we had a lot of Queenslanders and New South Welshmen. They had picture theatres and things, and we were wait. And I was probably there for, I don't know, over a month.
What happened when you finally were sent home?
Yeah, well...
What next? What do you do next having been involved with Z-Force? And
We're waiting for a troop ship. And I eventually came along, and away we went, of course, back to Australia. And then you've got to go through the process of getting to where you want to go. Even when we get back to Australia, we were offloaded in Brisbane, and of course all these transit camps are not too good, I can tell you. And you never ever put your gear down, or if you want to go and relieve yourself, you say to your mate, "Now you sit on my gear while I go," because they weren't very nice, I can tell you. Anyway, so eventually we got back to Melbourne. Now that's headquarters, and we were actually not in the Australian Army, because we'd been assigned to SRD. So SRD had to discharge us out of there back into the Australian Army. So that's where things changed a bit, I must admit. Though we had leave in Melbourne for about 4 weeks, no, about 3 weeks, I think. And then you had to report back every night, and then eventually they say, right, there's a troop train, you're going back to Western Australia. You see, you can imagine a huge amount of volume of troops coming from everywhere and trying to get home. So, and if you didn't have any priorities, like a wife and starving kids, you didn't rate very high. So eventually got home. And
what was that like, to get home after your experience, after your adventure?
Well, it was quite incredible, especially, you see, my parents knew that I was back in Australia, but they really didn't have any contact with me for, I suppose, nearly 9 months. So they didn't have the faintest idea whether I was still around or alive or whatever. So anyway, it was wonderful to get home. And the Claremont Showgrounds was the D-Mob But here again, I still didn't have enough points to get out. But just by fluke, I don't quite know how it happened, but they said, look, we need someone in the orderly room. So I got posted to the orderly room, which checks the guys out as they come in for their discharge. They go through everything. And then I had with another colleague, I had a very good job of handing out their coupons, because they've got to have clothing coupons, because you can't buy them without coupons. You've got to have tea coupons, because you can't buy the tea, and sugar and and of course, Paramount, petrol coupons. So I did that to, again, some months before I got out. I did have it down here somewhere.
What was it like to get out? What was it like to get out of the army and to get back into civilian life after a war, after your experience?
Yeah, well, it was quite extraordinary, I suppose. I'm just trying to.
Getting out into civilian life. What was that like after your experience?
Well, normal disciplinary things that you've got to do, you can please yourself. You can sleep in if you want to. And
some people say that sort of getting back into the sort of rhythm of life was actually a bit difficult. Was that something you experienced?
Well, not so much difficult, but it's to find something to do. You know, where you're going to go. You do get, on your way out of the army, you do have interviews and what have you. But then you might say the amount of opportunities, unless you were fortunate enough to be a student doing some course pre-war, and then could go back into a post-war, but however.
What did you end up doing?
So I must admit I probably played around like a lot of us did. Having a good time, and not that we really had all that much to spend, you might say. You got your deferred pay and a few things like that, but that wasn't a huge amount. And then I finally linked up with something which I was more or less doing getting back into the actual sales side. And I did that for quite a year or so, and then a friend of mine said, look, I'm going to Sydney, you'd like to come to Sydney? And I thought, well, that's a good idea, so I went to Sydney. And which was quite illuminating, because it was still after the war, not all that long after, and there's still lots of American troops and what have you in, especially in New South Wales. And I lived in Maclay Street, which is, you know, just up from the King's Cross, and it was quite illuminating.
How did you find that your service helped you in later life, do you think?
Well, okay, after I did my little Sydney venture. I came back here and joined a friend of mine in his business, and he was similar. But I think it helped you, because people, as you settle back in the establishment, call it the establishment, they get to know of you and what you did. So you, and you see, which I don't think I've mentioned before, but pre-war, I did a lot of sailing, as I mean, that's, which really got me into Z Special, SOD, and I went back into sailing, competitive sailing. So you know, you build up, and in the winter time, because of my rugby experiences in waiting to get home from Leborn, I played rugby in the winter time. So you build up a comradeship of fellows, and rubs off on what you do in business and all sorts of things.
People talk about giving them a confidence that they wouldn't have had they not experienced military action service.
Oh, I'm sure that, you know, and particularly discipline.
When you look back at your experience, when you look back at your time with Z Special, what do you say? What few words spring to mind?
I was very lucky.
Would you do it again, knowing what you know now?
Well,
and given a bit of age, maybe?
That's a $64 question, because, you know, when you volunteer for something, well, you poke your neck out, I guess. And sometimes you're volunteering, which I know I did, because of sheer boredom, because there wasn't much happening what I was doing, and suddenly I found myself in a completely different sphere of warfare, and quite frankly, looking back on it, I wouldn't have missed it for quids.
Well, Ross, unless you've got something else to say, I'd like to thank you very much for all your help. It's been great. Good
afternoon. Yeah.